We have this evening a rare double header. A team which has already described itself as a Tom and Jerry act, and one member of the team has described himself as a member of the senior evil management, but not the one that I suspect you think. I've got Maurice Cheng with me this evening. Maurice, good evening. Maurice, as you, I'm sure, know, is chief executive of the Institute of Osteopathy. He has a very deep, resonant voice, as I'm sure you know, and he's played Herod in a number of productions of Jesus Christ Superstar, hence the claim to be senior evil management. And we have Tim Walker with us. Tim previously described himself, or owned up to having been formerly a spin doctor, and is the voice, of course, of the General Counsel. Gentlemen, it's a very good evening. I would shake your hands, Tim, but you're a long way
And stay away.
Maurice, I said we'd start with you, because I know you two do a lot of road shows where you explain your relative roles, but there will be plenty of people who don't get to see those. We do, of course, get, those who are members, get the IO magazine, but perhaps you'd like to run through what's new, what's current in the Institute at the moment.
Well, okay, where do we start? I've been in post for just over 2.5 years now, and it really is, or has been, a complete roller coaster. I think what we've been trying to do is actually reframe what originally the BOA was actually all about. And, you know, the move to the Institute of Osteopathy, the IO, is as much about making a public statement that we are new and different as anything else. Mm. The first year I was in role, basically going out and reaching out to the rest of the profession. The profession is, as I'm sure everyone understands, it's a broad church, and wow, is it fragmented. You get modalities arguing with each other. You get, at one point, I think, you know, the BOA used to compete with, you know, COE and NCORE and yell at GIOSC a lot. If we are going to make the most sense out of the future of osteopaths and osteopathy, I am convinced that it's about collaboration, cooperation. And we've been working with GIOSC and COE and OA and others to try and effect that future for us. So we're basically now, you know, 2.5 years in, now getting to the stage where we feel that we are working really quite closely with other osteopathic stakeholder organizations, you know, the universities, postgraduate colleges, the Center of Research, as well as the regulator. And, you know, now's the year we need to start to reach out, because at the end of the day, if we are to gain, which is the phrase I just started to use and I suppose realise we need to use, I think, universal acceptance as a profession, i.e., you know, every patient, every member of the public, every doctor knows what osteopathy is and what it can bring to them. Mm. We actually need to collaborate and work together to get there. We're not going to do it without reaching out.
That's an interesting point, isn't it? I think in the survey that the General Counsel commissioned, something like 32% of the 1,000-odd people who were questioned across the United Kingdom didn't know what osteopaths did. So clearly getting that message out is important.
Indeed, indeed. And we just started a certain amount of tracking, for example, of what percentage of the population actually use osteopaths. Mm. And, the pleasing results are that any one year, roughly 1 million adults do, which is good. Unfortunately, while existing patients are our best ambassadors for new patients, the total proportion of adults who use osteopaths ever stops at 10%. So, you know, there is a limit to how far that word of mouth is going. Yes. We need to reach out.
Yeah. And that same survey that was in the Osteopath, I think, last edition or previously, it commented that amongst people who've used osteopaths, the rating is very high, but of those who don't use osteopaths, they rated us well below physiotherapists and dentists in terms of the trust that they had in us. Do you think that was a useful survey in that regard?
I think it's useful information to have. I don't think it was very surprising. It echoes things that we've seen before. But it does highlight to me that there's, you know, still a big job to be done, primarily by osteopaths and their professional association, to raise public awareness of osteopathy. But I think our role in that, and I think people understand we don't have a role in promoting osteopathy, but we do have a role in ensuring that the public understand that if they go and see an osteopath, this is someone who is well-trained, who keeps up to date with their practice, is insured, is linked up with other osteopaths. So we have a role there as well, but it's a complementary role, it feels to me, to the one that the Institute plays. But actually it comes back to the the primary players in this have got to be the osteopaths themselves, yes, and their patients who are their best advocates.
Yes, I mean, what you just described sounds a little bit like a requirement effectively to promote osteopathy, because if you're going to reach out to potential patients to assure them that we are safely regulated, you can only do that, surely, by sending out that message yourselves.
No, I don't think it's about promoting osteopathy. And, you know, it might sound odd, but we have relatively little interest in the type of osteopathy people do, the things that they do as osteopaths. I don't make distinctions between that. Or indeed, whether there is more or less osteopathy. That's not a matter for the regulator. But providing assurance to the public that if they see an osteopath, that their minimum expectations can be met, and a lot more, I hope, besides, I think is a role for us. But I think that's not promotion per se.
Okay. You did say, I think, in our last broadcast from here, that actually there are no osteopaths employed within the GOSC?
That's we have somebody who's doing some work for us at the moment, but that's normally the case is that we don't have anybody on the staff who's an osteopath. I think it's an interesting discussion to have. I mean, we're a small organisation, and it would be perfectly possible for there to be osteopaths employed here if they were interested in particular roles. We have there's no restriction on an osteopath working at the GOSC. I think the danger is that if you have a handful of osteopaths on your staff, that is the lens through which you start looking at osteopathy, where actually I think the approach that we take, that I've taken over the last 5 years of engaging with the profession, getting out and meeting the profession, actually spending time with osteopaths, with their organisations. So, for instance, all the members of the Osteopathic Alliance. This morning we had all the osteopathic educational institutions in this building for a meeting. We talk about things with them. That actually gives us a richer picture of osteopathic practice, osteopathic education, osteopathic research than we would get if we fell back on a handful of people who are on the staff of the GOSC. I think that's probably replicated across the majority of regulators as well, who are not, you know, the GMC is not staffed up by doctors,
yes,
the Optical Council isn't staffed up by optometrists.
No. Do you think, it occurred to me as I was travelling down here today, that having the title osteopath in the council's name actually can confuse some people, because I'm thinking of a specific case of a person who wanted to raise a complaint against an osteopath, but her opinion in the lack of response that she got was that effectively the GOSC was in cahoots with osteopaths, and therefore there was no independence. And similarly, a hell of a lot of osteopaths are very upset that the GOSC doesn't promote osteopathy and perhaps don't recognise that it is an independent body. It's not here to promote us.
Well, I personally find the title of all these regulators, the General Osteopathic Council, the General Medical Council, very confusing. It doesn't really mean anything to me, and it dates back to 1858, and we're stuck with it. And I think, you know, rebranding ourselves as the osteopath regulator or something would not be sensible. There's been a move over the last 20 years of moving away from professions regulating themselves to ones where there is an independence of regulation. That's why we have a council that is 50% osteopaths, 50% lay people. And that's the same across all the regulators. And, you know, while we are, you know, I think some people accuse us of being too close to the profession, some people accuse us for being too remote from the profession, and maybe that's right, that actually we get criticised on both sides, because there should be a balance, because we are here to represent the patient interest, but we're also here to work with the osteopathic profession to ensure that they're at the highest standards of osteopathic practice. And interestingly, I mean, we were joking about the Tom and Jerry thing with the IO and Morris. And, you know, Morris and I work well together. We also disagree on things. And that is absolutely critical, because at times, you know, our principal priority is to represent the public interest, not the interest of osteopaths.
Yes. Yeah, and I didn't mean to give any false impression when I accused you of being a Tom and Jerry act. I mean, it's not as though this is a, you know, it's a light-hearted, it's a very serious relationship.
Yes, yes.
But actually, that's a very good point, Morris, for you. And I'm going to read a question out here about this. As I say, all our questioners are anonymous, but this one reads, I and a number of my colleagues are very concerned about how close the IO appears to be to the Register. There are, which I would call the Council, I suppose, there are clear conflicts of interest. When you should be representing only the interests of osteopathy and its practitioners, is there not a danger that you'll be seen as colluding with the dumbing down of osteopathy in order to make it more palatable to the beleaguered orthodox medical system? Long question, but...
It's a long question. That's probably, I think, four long questions. Good to get into one.
Are you too close to the council?
No. We fight tooth and nail with GIOSC where required, and basically, yes, we are very much on the side of the rights and protection of the individual osteopath where we feel that things need correcting. I mean, we've waged a sort of 12-year-long battle with GIOSC's Fitness to Practice team, for example, and it's been lively. But at the same time, there are issues in which if we continued, sorry, if we did nothing but fight against the regulator, things just wouldn't progress. My personal experience is that this is actually the first statutory regulated profession I've been in. In most of the other roles I've played over the last 15-odd years, I've worked in self-regulated,
yes,
where the same organisation basically both policed itself and promoted the profession.
Yeah.
So I treat Tim and his lot as basically our police force to make sure that actually the standards are adhered to, because ultimately, unless we can guarantee as a profession that the standards are being upheld and that the clients, patients, the public, our customers are actually delivered, sorry, they actually get the right quality of product or service, then we all lose. You know, the act of promotion is not just about sort of saying, I'm an osteopath, buy me. It's about ensuring that, it's about reassuring that the right standards are being adhered to and this is what you can expect, and not only actually promoting that, but actually making sure that we've got teeth when it doesn't happen.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's why I think there is an appropriate relationship, both in terms of, actually, we don't think you're doing the right thing by that person, or, you know, this actually needs looking at. But at the same time, actually, there does need to be cooperation where the interests of the whole profession are at heart.
Well, you teased us a bit there. What are these areas of contention that you mentioned earlier on when you...
Well, I mean,
there are some examples that might be of interest to our
For example, I have worked for other health regulators where they have what are now called threshold criteria. So, you know, the ability of the regulator to actually look at a case and say, actually, there's nothing to do with us, or these are not serious enough to look at, which actually hasn't been the case with the GIOSC until fairly recently. And I think, you know, it's a good thing that GIOSC actually did ask the IO for their opinions on what those thresholds could be.
Right.
And actually, we were part of, I hope, the team that helped to make the new approach to the fitness practice process actually fairer, because there are an awful lot of, there used to be an awful lot of cases coming through which really shouldn't have hit investigation at all.
Yeah, we actually, we did have a question come in before we started the broadcast about that very thing, it was a discussion really with me by email about that business of dealing with complaints against practitioners, and the Institute's guidance is inform the Institute, inform your insurer. Of course, what the practitioner will want to avoid is that complaint getting to the General Counsel, because of the, you know, it's emotionally quite stressful when you feel that something's been elevated to that level. What would you say should be the correct procedure then in dealing with a potential complaint before it has actually been elevated?
It's fairly straightforward. Our expectation, and this is in the osteopathic practice standards, is that practitioners should have some mechanism themselves for dealing with concerns and complaints raised by their patients, and that's a fundamental part of being a healthcare professional. And we would hope that the majority of things would be dealt with locally in that way. I mean, we don't go fishing for complaints, and we have quite a lot of initial inquiries that come to us where people say, should I raise a complaint? And actually, one of the first things we might say to them is, have you talked to the practitioner first? Have you gone back to them and talked to them about it? And a good example of that is where people will ring up and say, you know, I went to the osteopath and actually I feel worse than I did. Part of the problem is that the osteopath perhaps didn't explain to them that they might have some kind of treatment reaction, and for 24, 48 hours they may feel worse and it'll calm down and they'll feel a lot better. Now, we wouldn't want to deal with that as a complaint if it was something that could be dealt with locally. Or, for example, if somebody says, I think I was overcharged for something, you know, that's something you should be able to deal with, and it's not a matter for the GOSC.
If they made a formal complaint about pricing, would you look into that?
Well, it's interesting. Our legislation is really quite unhelpful in as much as it says that we should investigate every single complaint that is made to us. And I know one of the things that the audience, some of the audience will probably want to talk about and we'll come on to is advertising, because that's where this comes in. So we're supposed to look at every single kind of complaint that comes to us. And as Maurice just mentioned, we've just been developing a new approach that says there are some certain low-level complaints that will never reach the threshold to be considered unprofessional conduct. Yes. And therefore they shouldn't be a matter for the GOSC. And some of those, particularly disputes between practitioners, you know, using the fitness to practice process to resolve a complaint with a neighbouring osteopath, a dispute with a neighbouring osteopath, is not the right approach. I think the interesting thing, we were having a discussion about this earlier, is that if we start to reject some of these complaints, and I think that's right, that doesn't mean there isn't still a grievance. And I think it's or something that needs some resolution. And I think it'd be interesting to see if the IO can play a role in some mediation between patients and osteopaths when those kind of things arise. But, you know, we as a regulator should be looking primarily at major complaints that are of concern around patient safety.
Yes. So, Maurice, when Tim sends the complainant back to the osteopath and they have this discussion and the patient complains that they weren't warned about the treatment reaction and they think they were overcharged for their ice pack or whatever it might have been. Is that a stage where the osteopath should phone the IO and say, look, this may go somewhere, I don't know?
And they do already. And we've actually been running a mediation service for about 3 or 4 years now, effectively we will take a patient complaint and seek to set up a dialogue between patient and osteopath and, where possible, resolve it. You know, we are obviously very careful about the conditions when that happens, but actually we're not bad at it. We probably, to the patient's satisfaction, actually arrange for about a half dozen instances a year where essentially there is no further action taken.
I think it's important as well, you know, I talk at meetings all over the country and you know, over the last 5 years, I've probably spoken in meetings with about half of the profession present, and with events like this, it's growing further. And we always end up talking about complaints and fitness to practice, but it's tiny.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, there are, last year I think we had 40 complaints that were investigated, 20 of those proceeded to a panel. That's very, very low, and much lower than any other regulated profession. So that's kind of a positive message to me. You know, unfortunately, some of the same kind of things come up time and again, and I think there's more that we can do as a regulator and with the IO as well to work with osteopaths to try and avoid these kind of complaints. You know, the fewer complaints there are to us, as far as we're concerned, the better. It's good for the reputation of the profession, and it's good for us and osteopaths in turn, because it reduces our costs.
costs may well come up this evening, because it generally seems to, doesn't it? But this is related. This question that's just come in is related to that, and it goes back to what you said earlier on about the GRSC having no osteopaths permanently employed on the staff. Would it be more sensible to have a single overarching health regulator rather than having several independent bodies, which would therefore incur an economy of scale if they were all combined into one? And I know there was a lot of resistance to osteopaths coming under the Healthcare Professions Council when the whole thing first began. How do you feel about that? Why do we need our own body?
Ultimately, it's not for us to decide. Parliament will decide how many regulators. The government will decide how many regulators there are. Interestingly, there's not a linear relationship between. Not a completely linear relationship between costs of regulators and their size. Mm. Some of the big ones are quite expensive as well. I mean, for instance, the dentists now pay £900 a year to be registered with the General Dental Council. There is a model, and Australia has this model where there's a single overarching healthcare regulator, but it's dealing with smaller numbers. I mean, in the UK, if you aggregated all the regulators together, you'd end up with nearly 1.5 million registrants, maybe 1.2, yeah, about 1.45 million registrants. Mm. At some point, someone might want to do that. At some point, someone say they may want to merge some of the smaller ones into a larger body. I actually, I think that needs to be considered on its merits at the time. I think one of my concerns, and this is some of the work we've done, we've tried to do with the IO, the colleges, the Osteopathic Alliance and others, is you start to think about a world where there isn't an osteopathic specific regulator and think about some of the building blocks of what the profession needs to be doing in that future world. And that's some of the work we've been doing through the Osteopathic Development Group has been looking specifically at that, and I think that's the right thing to do. Obviously I'd be out of a job, but I think we should be relatively neutral about whether there should be a GOSC or not, and that's for others to decide.
Is your opinion sought on that issue by government? Or would it be?
I suspect if they decided to do that, we would find that out at a fairly late stage. The most recent suggestions from them is that they would keep the sector as it is. But, you know, who knows what tomorrow will bring.
Yeah. Similar sort of question, Maurice. I mean, do you have much to do with your equivalent body in, say, the chiropractic world? Because we have chiropractors who are our members, as well as physiotherapists, or physiotherapy, of course.
I meet my opposite number at the BCA, which I know is only one of the four bodies in chiropractic, pretty regularly, and we discuss common issues about communication, promotion, and so on. So yes, we do. I do, however, pretty firmly wear the hat that I'm paid to promote osteopaths, and I do tend to resist calls for any form of merger with any other body.
I'm not suggesting for a second there should be a merger. I'm interested to know whether the issues are the same, whether there are lessons that can be learned from talking to the Chiropractic Association. Do they have the same problems and issues as us?
Yes. But they charge a lot more as well, so they have a lot more ability to actually deal with some of the stuff that gets lobbed at them. We face exactly the same challenges in terms of on the path towards universal acceptance. Yes. But they have a very different environment, they have a very different community that they service, in that they do appear to have, for example, far more business training right at undergraduate level, for example, and therefore, rightly or wrongly, I think there are differences in view about whether osteopaths are too gentle and the chiropractors are too business-like, or whatever it is, but there are differences in approach. which I think we should see to understand from it sometimes.
Well, actually, I mean, I am intent on getting a senior member of the chiropractic establishment on one of these broadcasts one evening, because I think this mythology that builds up between the professions is quite unhelpful. I mean, I've met a number of chiropractors, and other than McTimony chiropractors, who are different from osteopathy and from other chiropractors, a lot of them seem to be pretty much the same as us. You know, yet they have some of them have their what we would regard as odd little tools, but their approach to the patients is very similar. Yes. I have found. Yeah. And I think it would be helpful to break down some of those barriers. You mentioned they've got more money. We have a question is, do we need to pay you to do more? The questioner doesn't know how you achieve as much as you do for such a modest subscription, but what would you do? What would you like to do if you had more funds? Would you be perceived as more independent from the General Council?
As I say, I we are not working with GLS because we want their money. It's always helpful, by the way, but no. I mean, the money angle is not the reason why we work in collaboration with, I say, GOSC and universities and so on. It's about the fact that we all need to be on the same page. Sorry, horrible phrase, but yes. We all need to agree on the same strategies about how we take the profession forward. I mean, one of the things I tend to, and I'm sticking my neck out, I suppose, tend to say when I'm addressing regional society for the first time is that I think the profession back in 1993, when the Act was passed, you know, at that point we'd spent the most recent 25 years going for regulation because it was the solution to all our woes. It wasn't. Mm. And you know what I keep saying is that I think to a large extent we went to sleep as a community because we thought, great, you know, GEOS is coming, you know, salvation is on its way, we don't need to do any more. Mm. And the sort of attitude about well, GEOS is going to do it all pervades. And I suspect quite a lot of the bad press that I understand you occasionally get, you know, is you know, GEOS aren't delivering on the original promise. Well, it can't do. It's a regulator. You know, it is not a super professional body. So I think very much I think the focus nowadays actually has to be to gather all the elements within, for example, the structure that is currently called the Osteopathic Development Group, to actually work together towards the common goals of what are the structures, how do we present ourselves better to patients, public in general, government, and so on. So it's working together that's the driver. Coming back to the question about finances, yes, we could do with having a richer source of funding to invest more. I mean, there are lots of projects that we need volunteers to help man, and it would be great to have a bit more money so that we could actually, you know, progress faster.
Yeah. What did you have in mind?
A first $500 million would be great, because that will take care of, you know, take the edge off starting a lot of projects.
What's your funding level at the moment? I haven't looked that
well. We have a sub-£1 million turnover. The accounts are public, and we invest all the surplus we make, which is about, well, the surplus. If we did nothing new and then we just maintained the organisation as a membership body and provided the sort of core services, we'd make about sort of £50,000 surplus a year. Actually, what we do is we invest every penny of that in projects such as within the ODG, sorry, the Osteopathic Development Group, and other things that we do to advance support for the profession. You know, as one example, we are currently talking, we're piloting a template website for regional societies. There are roughly 30 of them. Many of them don't have websites that they communicate either to the public or to their own members with. And we've now built one that we're offering to any regional society who wants to use it. So we're developing tool sets for the profession to start to use.
Yes. As a general rule of thumb, osteopaths are not good with technology. That may be changing as a sort of younger generation comes through, but there are still a lot of osteopaths who haven't got that profile themselves, and it doesn't surprise me that those voluntary groups don't have it either. This is, I think, probably a very straightforward question for you, Tim. I mean, does the GOSC publish its funds? And you're a government body.
Yes, absolutely. Our annual accounts are published. Annual report and accounts went to the July meeting of council. You can find them on our website. They've now been designed. I don't know whether they've been posted. They were supposed to be posted in September, and it's still September. That's all very transparent. it lists everything like salary details, all of those kind of things. Incidentally, we don't pay the IO any money for anything, so I'm not sure what Maurice quite has in mind there.
Half a million, I think.
No, not at all.
No.
I mean, as you know, Maurice touched on this, and I think it's I think the profession needs to think about how it invests in itself. And the area, I mean, there is obviously there's lots of different things it could do. The area I'm concerned about is around research. And, you know, my view is very firmly that if we are going to develop an evidence base for osteopathy, that requires some investment in research. There's different ways of doing it. The IO has funded NCORE with a project on patient-reported outcome measures, which I think is fantastically important because that allows us to collect data about the patient experience of osteopathic practice. But let's think about where we go beyond that, because, you know, at the end of the day, the principal funding sources for research in osteopathy are going to be osteopaths and their patients. And, you know, if every osteopath in the UK could collect £1 a week, so one patient giving £1 each week, we would be in a position where there could be, you could fund a decent randomly controlled trial each year. And that's not very much money. And I remember an osteopath in Scotland saying to me, I don't understand why for the last 10 years I've had a collecting box on my reception for cancer research and not had one for osteopathic research.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Cancer is a somewhat more emotive issue, isn't it, though?
It may well be, but if you've got satisfied customers, patients, in your clinic and you're saying to them, listen, we want to research this more, it seems to me it's going to be a no-brainer. Because actually, otherwise, you know, not trying to do that is just an excuse to say it can't be done.
Yeah. This makes our conversation a little haphazard, but there's a question that goes back to sanctions again.
Mm.
Somebody has commented that they recently reported an osteomyologist, both to the IO and to the GEOSC, for advertising online under the category of osteopath on search engines. And apparently this was investigated for over a year and no sanctions were imposed. That does appear to be wrong. How does that process normally
work? It's quite difficult. This is what's called an investigation under Section 32 of the Osteopaths Act, which is around illegal practice. And we get quite a few reports of this. The way in which we normally address them in the first instance is to write what is called a cease and desist letter. So a legal letter goes out to somebody and quite often someone will take down the whatever it says on a website or whatever, and it's a reasonable success rate. The evidential requirements are quite high for a private prosecution in this area, and I don't know the circumstances of this particular case, but it may be that simply a search word on a search engine did not provide enough evidence to us that we were likely to get a successful prosecution. Now, if we take a private prosecution, which we do on a number of occasions each year, we have to assess whether we are going to, A, whether we're going to win, and B, whether we're going to recover our costs from that. Hmm. Because if we can't do both of those, it's not cost effective. So it is a limited number of times where we will take it to court, and I'm afraid a limited number of times where we will win.
The profession might argue that it's irrelevant whether you get your costs back. It's important to protect our reputation by not having people misleading the public and masquerading as osteopaths.
Yeah, I agree with that. But you know, we do seek costs wherever we can. Mm. But it's not cheap to undertake these prosecutions. I mean, there was one very high-profile one, for example, in Scotland, where bringing a private prosecution is a very difficult matter, and we had to get a particular leave from the court to do it. And that process, which took a number of years, eventually cost us, I think, £40,000 to £50,000. And we've only now 4 or 5 years later, got all the money back from that prosecution because we had a charge on the guy's house. Yeah. I mean, we do take this stuff very seriously.
Why does it have to be a private prosecution? I mean, they're breaking the law, surely.
Yes, they are. But I'm not aware of any situation where the police and the Crown Prosecution Service have sought to prosecute an offence under Section 32 of the Osteopaths Act. Mm. Now, I don't necessarily think that's a good thing. I would like the police to do these things, yeah. but they don't. So yes. that's why we choose, in some circumstances, to take private prosecutions.
Yeah.
I say most of the time, the Section 32 approach bites. We're actually going through a process at the moment where we're reviewing historically all of the files, because some of these things, yeah. what happens is that something pops up, we send a cease and desist letter, it disappears, and you actually have to check in and make sure that it doesn't happen again. We're just going through a process of reviewing that. I know it's very frustrating. It's very frustrating for us, because we want people to stop doing this as well, but it's not a straightforward process. And it's also a problem as well, where part of the problem is the offence, you have to be able to identify that the offence has been committed by an individual. So just a brass plaque outside a door saying osteopath is not enough. We need to find an individual holding themselves out to be an osteopath. Sometimes that's through things like a treatment receipt that says osteopathic treatment. Mm-hmm. You know, Joe Bloggs, and a date and a price at the bottom. That's the kind of evidence sometimes we need right. in order to take these things forward.
If a person's, this is getting a bit geeky and I apologise, but if a person's website has meta tags which say osteopathy, osteopath, to try to draw that search traffic towards it, does that constitute that individual misrepresenting themselves?
I think it does constitute them misrepresenting themselves. Whether it would reach the evidential threshold required for a successful prosecution, I think is highly unlikely.
This was reported to the IO as well, Maurice. Does the IO have a role in this?
What we tend to do is actually flag it to GIOS to pursue, because they have more authority, powers and money than we do. So yes, we take all these things very seriously, but first port of call, report to GIOS as well.
Well, Tim, you mentioned that advertising standards might raise its head sometime during the conversation.
What a surprise. Well,
can I start with you, Maurice? I mean, we just had a lot of communication from the Institute about people phoning receptionists to try to get them to claim that we could treat things such as colic in babies. How's that going? I mean, have you had any more reports of that happening? Or?
There do appear to be several dozen more complaints being raised on similar lines about, you know, children, babies, cranial, and so on. There are certain keywords that obviously they're focusing on. And you know, it's a deliberate drive. And basically, I think what we are treating it as is an opportunity for us to work with the profession to start to address issues around how we talk about what we do.
Yes.
And I mean, for example, we've just opened up a specific email box where, in fact, you know, as of today, about sort of 30 odd osteopaths have actually sent in examples of other complaints they've received or issues around copy advice, for example. I think the issue about being clearer about how we can express what osteopathy can bring has been sitting around for quite a long time. And just needs to be, I think, taken much more seriously than has been. So what our approach is at the moment is to work with the postgraduate colleges and obviously GIOSC and the universities as well, just to try and get a team together to sort of say, well, using the basis of the complaints that are coming in, you know, what is being complained about?
Yes.
What can we do about the issues being complained about? I.e., in some cases, it's stuff that really shouldn't be talking about, so okay, that's kind of the easy bit. There are others where it's just the osteopath hasn't been able to substantiate a claim. Now, you know, with the universities on board, with NCOR on board, we'll actually find it a lot easier to provide the substantiation, we hope, to some issues. Other issues are just basically that there isn't enough evidence, and perhaps we should go and gather some.
Yes.
So we're trying to analyse the issues of complaint, coming up with a response to each category, like things we don't need to do anything about, things we can do something about, things we can approach perhaps and discuss with the ASA around.
Yeah.
And actually do it on an organised, as an organised project.
Let me turn to one of the questions about the ASA, and I'm afraid this is directed at the General Counsel,
yeah,
Tim.
Sure.
And I'm going to quote, I'd hate you to think these were my words, why do you waste our time and money in the form of postage paid for by our subscription by continually promoting the flawed agenda of the ASA in the form of the cap code? It's none of your business, but a potential matter between the individual osteopath and the ASA, or is the ASA paying for it, and are you merely fronting for them?
Well, the bits of that, actually, I agree with, and I'll come on to that. Let me explain the genesis of this, because I think it's really important. As I said earlier, we normally get about 40 complaints a year to the GOSC. Since July, we have had 79 complaints about advertising alone. So twice the normal volume of complaints for a year, yes, in 3 months, just about advertising.
And these have come direct to you or via the ASA or to both organizations?
They have come direct to us, yeah, from an organization, okay, right, with an agenda. Yeah. Now, that's an aside. Okay. Now, I'm really clear that it's not the job of the GOSC to be an advertising regulator, okay? There is a regulator for advertising. It's called the Advertising Standards Authority. Where I think our role would come in is if an osteopath refused to comply with a ruling from the ASA. Now, as I said earlier, we have a duty at the moment to investigate every complaint that comes to us. And that is extremely time-consuming and costly process. And I would like to minimise that burden on the osteopathic profession. Now, I'll come back to the complaints and what we're doing with them. But let me put it this way. The cost of bringing to the attention of the profession the requirements of the ASA, of the CAP code, the ASA's requirements, is minuscule compared to the costs of dealing with one, let alone 79 complaints, yes, under our procedures.
Is it worth just explaining that the Advertising Regulation Organisation is in three structures? The ASA, the Advertising Standards Authority, which actually receives the complaints, the Committee on Advertising Practice, which produces the guidelines, and there's a bit in the middle that raises the money for them both, isn't there?
Yeah,
funny enough, I think they're a limited company, aren't they? The advertising.
That's right. And well, I'll come back to that because so what we're trying to do with these 79 complaints is come up with a mechanism to ensure that they can be resolved, yeah, if possible, informally, between the individual registrant and the ASA stroke CAP, so that they don't have to be considered by us, the GOSC. So to that extent, your questioner is right. Isn't this a matter between the ASA and the registrant? Yes, I agree with that. Now, as you said, there's two parts to the ASA. There's the CAP that produces the code of practice, which is a bit like the osteopathic practice standards, and then the ASA, which is the enforcement body. And they do sit in the same building. Now, your questioner talks about the flawed agenda of the ASA and CAP. Well, first of all, there is a bit of a mythology out there that there is no law relating to advertising. And there is. It's set at the EU level. And successive British governments have enforced that using the ASA, which they call a voluntary regulator. So that is the legitimate authority for advertising matters. Where some of the problems arise is that the CAP guidance on osteopathy is really difficult to interpret, and some of it is downright unhelpful or just a bit odd. I mean, there are things in there like talking about you can't deal with minor sports injuries, where the concept of minor is not a medical term as far as or a health care term as far as I'm concerned. So there are some things that we need to iron out. So our strategy is to try to minimise the costs to the GOSC and therefore to registrants, to try to get as many of these matters resolved as quickly as possible and most efficiently in a proportionate manner, to bring to the attention of osteopaths, and we've been trying this for the last 5 years, you know, writing in articles in a magazine, etc., saying, you know, you need to look at your websites, check they're compliant, to try to bring the profession into compliance, and at the same time work with the CAP to help them understand a bit more about how osteopathy works, and that, you know, condition-based treatments are not where osteopathy is. And in fact, the IO ourselves and are meeting the CAP next week to actually talk through whether the guidance that's provided can be improved. So, yeah, I think there are flaws in it, but at the moment it is the authority that people have to comply with.
And what are the sanctions open then to the Advertising Standards Authority? As I understand it, the first is to ask you to stop doing what you're doing, and ultimately it's Trading Standards who would deal with it as a legal matter. But what's in the middle?
Yeah, there is a range. You can actually you can end up with the Office of Fair Trading being involved, but I suspect that probably only happens on budget airlines rather than individual osteopaths. And yes, they could involve Trading Standards. The osteopathic practice standards are really straightforward. They say that you need to comply with what the ASA says.
Which is very confusing.
It may well be, but if there was a ruling against you from the ASA and you chose not to comply with it, we would consider that to be potentially unprofessional conduct. And I think that's reasonable. Yeah.
But of course, yes, people should not be misleading the public through their websites or their other publicity. But actually, it wouldn't be, if they believe in what they've got on the website, they could simply sit back and wait, and if no one complains, just leave it as it is.
They could do, but we
Because the first stage is only going to be, well, please stop doing it, at which point they stop doing it.
Yeah, and, you know, there's evidence to suggest that there's a systematic trawl through people's websites trying to find people who are non-compliant.
By the agency, the organisation that you mentioned
earlier.
Yeah,
and reporting them to us. Yeah. And I think they will carry on with that until they get bored. And so, I don't know how long that will take.
So are you involved, Maurice, with discussions with the ASA as well about promoting what osteopathy can do? Are you part of the meeting next week?
Very much so.
Yeah. Right then, gentlemen, what are you going to do to be more robust with the Advertising Standards Authority? Let's take colic, for example. Why can't we say that we can treat babies who are suffering with colic?
Well, because the answer to that is there is very little evidence that suggests that.
But there is evidence. There is a paper, 2009 or 10, by Hook and a couple of others, who showed that chiropractic care is beneficial in treating infantile colic. Well, general care, I'm not talking about manipulating necks, I'm talking about general care, which would apply to osteopathy.
I'm not particularly familiar with the evidence. I think whatever evidence there is, I know, for example, that NCOR's got a project at the moment looking at evidence around childhood diseases, conditions, and is trying to pull together a systematic review, and that might assist with providing evidence to the ASA. Yeah. I think some of this is, going to come down to patient-reported outcomes, and that's an area where the profession has a role in collecting, systematically data about outcomes.
I just worry, though, that the reason I mentioned that paper is because it was a case against a Wiltshire chiropractor, which the ASA looked into, and they found against the chiropractor, despite the fact that there was a systematic review of the evidence which showed that chiropractic care generally could improve infantile colic. Now, they found, presumably, that evidence was insufficient, and I would imagine that we could waste our time collecting patient outcome measures because they will say, well, you've collected this as an osteopath, that doesn't count as independent evidence, and it won't hold up.
Indeed, and one of the issues that we want to start to engage with the ASA and CAP committees with is precisely the threshold of evidence that they would find convincing. Because, as I say, it's At the moment, it is far from clear what words, you know, the words they use in terms of, you know, adequate substantiation, actually what it means. They mention RCTs, sort of randomized controlled trials, halfway through it, but yes. It's only given as an example, not definitive, yes. Thank God.
And there are RCTs and RCTs, aren't there?
Indeed. So, you know, one of the things that we need to just start to engage with is actually, what do you actually need? And, you know, at least that gives us a target that we're going to, we can actually work towards.
Do you expect them to answer that question? I don't expect they have the faintest idea.
On day one, no. But I think it's the sort of issue that we want to carry on engaging with them on until they actually give us an answer. Because until we get clarity, there is always going to be an opening for organisations to come and lob bits of mud. Yeah. So, you know, a huge part of the agenda next week when we go and see the ASA and CAP folk is just starting to engage to say, look, there are issues we need to talk about, because otherwise it is creating openings which are erroneous or misguided for people to accuse osteopaths of misrepresentation. But we need to start to understand what you feel are issues like, you know, sufficient evidence. Certainly, if they want to be definitive that RCTs are it, I think we need to push back, because actually I don't think even government will be that definitive about the need for RCTs anymore. Yeah. Incidentally, just as a direct plea, I find it a shame that the IO, having helped NCOR design a fantastic new PROMS tool, the uptake of it is, I think, pathetic is the word I'd like to use. You know, people just aren't picking it up on the basis that our patients won't like it. Well, actually, I think patients would love it. So please, you know, if we are in the business of trying to explain to the outside world that what we do is good, can we please use the tools that we can, which involve no effort by anyone really, apart from just saying to a patient, look, here's a PROMS tool, just tell us what you think. Because actually we understand that PROMS is becoming more and more the sort of data gathering that people listen to.
And interestingly, you mentioned a survey that we did around patients in one of your first questions.
It was an independent survey, wasn't it?
Yes, it was done by YouGov. And they surveyed both patients, people who had been to see an osteopath as a patient, and those who never had. And interestingly, the public, and I can't remember the figures, the public is reasonably relaxed about providing feedback to healthcare professionals. Yeah. Osteopaths' patients are more enthused by doing so than the general populace. So, you know, I think actually there is a willingness on behalf of patients to help us as a profession provide this kind of evidence of effectiveness. Yeah. But I think Maurice is right. You know, actually there has to be a dialogue and engagement with the ASA and CAP if it's ever going to change. Mm. If people just jump up and down and say it's not fair, then it won't change.
That's true. There's a catch-22 in this, isn't there? If you're going to use patient-reported outcome measures and you can't tell people you treat colic, you won't get any reported outcome measures for treating colic. So,
well, not necessarily. I'm not an expert on how the PROM tools work, but I, you know, I'm sure there are ways that can be done to do this. Let's be realistic though, that actually we know that the vast majority of patients go to see osteopaths on recommendations from patients, not from Googling local osteopath.
Yes, I agree. We've had a little flurry of questions come in as a result of that discussion, and it reflects what I was just about to say, that I think a lot of the discontent in our profession is that this is not a level playing field. Now, for example, to test it out, I Googled private treatment for frozen shoulders earlier on today, and Bupa are advertising that you can be treated using manipulation under anaesthetic. Now, we had Simon Lambert, who is the lead shoulder expert from the Royal National Orthopaedic Hospital, on one of these programs, who said there are 20% adverse effects in that treatment, and his words were that it is dangerous, and yet they can advertise that as a treatment. Statins are prescribed on the basis of highly flawed evidence to patients, as are other drugs, and yet we are worried because we are delivering a treatment, say to a baby, if we stick with colic, which has, as far as I'm aware, no incidence of harm to children and lots of clinical evidence of benefit, and that is perceived as not being a level playing field. How do we address that?
Well, I think, I mean, I don't know about the kind of website you found, but if there are private practitioners who are claiming something that they can't substantiate, then they are equally at risk as osteopaths are from complaints against them.
Let me take statins, though, because the evidence for statins is overwhelmingly negative, and yet the NHS virtually insists that over 50 you take them. And again, we've had another speaker on here who is one of the leading voices against statins. There is virtually no positive evidence for statins. There's lots of harm to them. But yet you can't take that to the Advertising Standards Agency. I suspect, I don't know where the advertising happens for drugs.
No, and actually quite often that's because it's not a commercial transaction that's involved. Yes. And I probably shouldn't tell this story, but Morris and I went to see the Chief Allied Health Professions Officer of NHS England. Mm-hmm. There is no chief officer in the NHS England for osteopathy. But we went to talk to her. I'd been with Mike Watson, Morris's predecessor, to see the previous incumbent, who was a physiotherapist, who took great delight in telling me that she used an osteopath. We were saying, you know, there is a limited amount of evidence for some of the things that osteopaths do. And she said, there's a limited amount of evidence for an awful lot of the interventions that the people I represent in NHS England do across the health professions. But the problem is, it's about the regulation around advertising is about the regulation of commercial transactions from businesses to consumers. And that's why it becomes an issue.
So is one of my questioners right in saying that you're perfectly at liberty to tell patients orally that you can treat conditions which the ASA would prohibit in print or in broadcast?
I think it's a grey area, okay, because...
Perhaps you better make sure the recording isn't on.
Well, that's a good point because, you know, you can go online and you can listen to a recording of somebody's receptionist making all sorts of claims. And my view is that your receptionist shouldn't be making claims on your behalf in any circumstances.
Yes, I've listened to that, and it did seem that the receptionists were stepping outside their area of competence.
Well, right? I also, you know, my view, and I may be wrong, and I'm not an osteopath, is that, you know, it's supposed to be something where most of the diagnosis takes place by hand and sight, not over the phone.
Well, diagnosis, yes. But I guess if you called my practice and somebody asked the receptionist, do you treat bad backs? She would say, yes, of course we do. Yeah. And maybe that practitioner is used to treating, I don't know what the occasion, was it colic in babies? Used to treating babies, and the receptionist said, oh, yeah, we can treat that all the time. Don't worry about that.
But that shouldn't be something. But actually, shouldn't the receptionist be saying, you would need to bring in the child and the osteopath would need to see them before they could determine whether there was something they could treat?
Yes.
I think that there's, you know, I think there are grey areas around what you say, because I don't think it would be professional to say that you could treat something when you couldn't. And you have to decide what you could and couldn't do, and there is a spectrum based on your experience, the things that you've done before. There's lots of discussions about evidence-based medicine that take place, and the guy who came up with the concept of evidence-based medicine never intended it to be just about research evidence, that it was actually involved the practitioner's experience and the patient's preferences as well. So the nature of the dialogue between the patient and the practitioner when they've had an examination and the osteopath says, I think I may be able to help you with this. Mm. You know, are you prepared for me to try? That's a very different kind of dialogue than saying, you know, got this condition, I can fix it. And that's where the commercial transaction stuff comes in.
But I think in the case... Sorry, do you...
I just wanted, I think, to reflect what everyone knows, which is, unfortunately, you know, A, yes, even I understand now that osteopaths treat people, not conditions, but new patients, if they spot a condition that they've got, you know, that's the reason they'll probably come to you in many cases.
They treat horses as well.
But you know, they'll come to you because they've got something.
Yes.
And the fact that actually diagnosis is completely something very different is you know, due to the credit of osteopaths. But when talking about advertising, I think it is particularly important for us to start to take seriously the question: how can we express what we do? Yes. And provide much clearer advice about how you describe what you do, because the sort of banned list and the allowed list is too simplistic.
Yeah. But Tim, in one of the copies of The Osteopath recently, you produced a list of what we're allowed to say we can treat. I'm sure it was in The Osteopath.
That's not my list. No, yeah. That is the list produced by the Committee of...
Sorry, it was in The Osteopath.
Yeah.
It was very thin and very weedy, and actually made us look like little more than glorified cosmetic massage therapists.
I totally agree with that, and that's why we're starting to have this conversation with the cap on what is the scope for this. And the example I always use is... because I went to my own osteopath for treatment for plantar fasciitis. That's not on the list, but I suspect it's something that osteopaths deal with quite a lot. Yes. Nothing to do, maybe a lot of the time, maybe nothing to do with the back.
Yes, but of course there isn't the evidence that osteopathy fixes it. Maybe there is some similar evidence in physiotherapy, because we probably use very similar techniques, of course. Yeah. But
it's not on a physiotherapist's list either.
Is it not?
There is a physiotherapist list, and that is even more restrictive.
So how do people find the list as it develops in the ASA's website? Is it easy
to
find?
It's on the CAP. If you go to go to the CAP website and you put in the search osteopathy, it will come up immediately.
Right. Okay. How much leeway do you think we have then in the way we express what we can treat? If we don't say that we can treat colic in infants, and I keep coming back to that because I think it's the most prominent of the complained about conditions, we say that you have a baby who may be in difficulties. It may be possible that we can help with certain types of condition. Can we be that vague in it, or do we have to stick to that horrible little list that was
You're starting to get me onto ground which I said I didn't want to be on. That's not because I don't want to be on it, and it's because you're actually saying to me, how should you interpret somebody else's code of practice?
Yes.
And I think it's quite critical that we don't try to do that. Now, I do think it's right that the IO is thinking about what language can be used, and there's work that needs to be done to explore that. It appears that there are some forms of words that do work and others that don't. Yeah. And there are also problems that arise from using testimonials, for example.
Well, yes, and on this on these broadcasts, and we've said in the past, well, as long as you use a testimonial, it's okay. But it's not, is it?
No.
If it implies that you can treat something.
It can be problematic, because I think wrongly, because it's a kind of slightly reductionist approach, the ASA consider the word treat to mean the same as cure.
Yes.
Now, it may be that in the public's mind, that's what they see and what they expect. But I think we all know that life is a bit more vague than that. And I think part of the discussion with the CAP has got to be about, you know, you can't deny the fact that people are doing this and they are content with it, and there is high levels of satisfaction, and sort of go down this route of saying, you know, you can't treat children and babies. I just don't think that's reasonable. That's the kind of discussion we're trying to have.
Is that your understanding of the current regulation of testimonials? As long as the person making the testimonial doesn't use the word treat, or maybe doesn't name a condition, then you can use it.
You're trying to get me to, you know, there is guidance about the use of testimonials on the CAP website. I don't think it would be right for me to try and interpret that. That's what I keep saying. We are not the regulator of advertising, and we're not going to be.
Do you think you're going to be able to influence the ASA?
We're going to make a damn good go at it. I mean, seriously, when we will do it on the basis of evidence both from the osteopathic profession, who are being complained about, hopefully a profession-wide drive to start to address issues that we should be able to talk about, because actually there is enough evidence, we just haven't presented it, and building evidence in places which where more is needed. And also, in fact, to this last issue about actually what do we do about patients who present with conditions that we see all the time, and there's not enough evidence for the time being, but you know, it's daft that we can't actually say, not allowed to currently say, that, you know, currently I see 12 patients a year who present with a condition. Yeah. Actually, what they're suffering from is completely different. What form of words can we use to describe the case around that patient or patients? And that those are sort of some of the approaches that we need to start to discuss with the ASA about how to deal with them.
And I think the important point that, you know, osteopaths are autonomous primary care practitioners, and they are trained to identify a range of common conditions, presentations, deal with what aspects of those they can, and refer on when they can't.
Yes.
And that seems to be an essential part of it, rather than the triage being done by the ASA, it should be done by the practitioner. Yeah.
Do you have goals for this meeting with the ASA? Have you got initial objectives to achieve in your discussions with them? You'd like the guidance to be clearer, but in how we, what would you like to see clarified specifically?
Well, there are a number of things. We've got an agenda. We're discussing with them, first of all, how we're managing the current cases that are live, and that's important. We did agree to do a joint communication with them, and obviously upset one of your viewers, maybe more, but I think was the right thing to do, to continue to bring this to the attention of the profession. There are some things that are on the agenda around the current conditions list and some clarifications we'd like to seek. There are some things that we're presenting to them in terms of recent advice to registrants, which we think goes beyond the current list of restrictions that they have, so where they are taking a broader interpretation. So that's something we need to discuss as well. And also, we want to try and seek a commitment from ASA CAP that we have an ongoing dialogue to start to try and resolve these things. And it shouldn't be, you know, one meeting is not going to fix this. No. It's going to be a long-term project.
It occurs to me that this, of course, does present quite a problem for the osteopath who is taking marketing of their services seriously, because, as you rightly pointed out there, Maurice, I mean, patients don't know necessarily what their condition is, and if they say, I've got plantar fasciitis, that's what they will search for on Google. Mm. And if we're not allowed to say we can treat plantar fasciitis, they won't find us necessarily. Mm. It makes me feel that there has to be some leeway for at least allowing patients to know that, it may be a condition we can treat, but they've got the wrong name for it.
I think we've got to be careful here not to over-egg this, because while we have had a number of complaints made about current advertising, I think it's fairly well known that we on a couple of occasions have done some quite extensive web searches of banned terms and written to osteopaths saying to them, look, you need to look at your website, see whether there's a problem. Now, we did that in 2011, and we wrote to about 400 osteopaths, and we did it in 2013, and we ended up writing to about just over 100 osteopaths.
Now, not the same ones, I hope.
No, I don't think they were the same ones. And we did that because, you know, we keep getting pressure from organised groups of people who are anti-osteopathy, chiropractic and a whole lot of other things and want to do that. Yes. And we were trying to encourage compliance. We didn't take action. We didn't take enforcement action against any of those osteopaths. We just asked them to check their websites, and they did.
Yes.
Now, I don't know how many osteopaths have in the UK have websites, but it's a hell of a lot more than that. So it seems that the vast majority of osteopaths are not finding it difficult to comply. Okay, yes. So it's a small group who are finding it that it is. So if there are folk out there who are finding it easy to comply, then it should be reasonably easy for everybody else too.
I suppose the reassuring thing, and again, I'm not suggesting that people should deliberately flout the regulations, but the reassuring thing is if you are using terminology which you think is correct and someone complains, you will be politely asked to stop doing it. It's not necessarily going to lead to being struck off the register or anything like that.
It seems to me to be highly unlikely that someone would be struck off the register anyway, given that tends to be something that is reserved for people who are usually in prison before the case gets to us or have committed serious offences. Yeah. So, you know, let's be proportionate. Yes. But as I said, we are not intending to become the regulator of advertising.
Indeed.
What we're trying to do, because we've had these complaints, we're trying to get them resolved informally, working with the ASA CAP, so that they don't have to become complaints that we have to investigate at great financial cost to ourselves and the profession, and also at personal cost to those who get involved with them.
Yes.
That's not a good thing to do. Can I just make a quick pitch, basically, that running in parallel with this programme is that we need to have more and more examples of where osteopaths feel that the advice being given by the CAP copy advice team just goes a bit beyond, or they don't understand it, or whatever, because we need that evidence in order to talk to the CAP committee about.
Yes.
So we've set up an email box, which is just asacampaign@osteopathy.org. If you've got examples of CAP copy advice team advice, which you find just above and beyond or unusual, send it in, because that's the sort of dossier of evidence that we need to start to address sort of issues we've just been discussing.
And actually, we should address this also to the practitioners in the audience who are not osteopaths, because you know this is not all about osteopathy, although it's obviously this evening going to be heavily orientated that way. I would suggest that other professions should do exactly the same, so that the pressure on the Advertising Standards Agency increases, so that we can claim to treat things which we know we can treat. And one of our questioners, that's very sensibly said, well, why are we teaching people to treat these conditions if we're not allowed to claim that we treat them? And I don't know if you had that discussion with the educational establishments earlier.
Well, as it goes back to the point that this is about marketing. Now, I think that one of the other questioners earlier, and you read it out, talked about us being in cahoots with the IO to dumb down osteopathy. Now, first of all, I reject that idea. And, you know, it's not our agenda to tell the osteopathic education institutions what they can and cannot teach in this way. You know, progress in any discipline in healthcare requires people to experiment and try things. Some of them will work, some of them will fail, and to gather appropriate evidence about whether they work or not. And that seems to be a perfectly reasonable thing. And it's a perfectly reasonable thing to teach. But it's also important that people understand what the limitations are about the evidence for the effectiveness of that too. And I think that's a duty on the colleges to teach that. Comes back to advertising is about commercial communications from businesses to consumers, and that's what's regulated by the ASA.
And perhaps some of the evidence will start to emerge as a result of the growing number of doctorate programmes that we have going on in osteopathy as well, where they can do some new and independent research into these conditions, so that we encourage people to take up those opportunities. On which subject? I mean, how does the IO's fellowship in Nottingham contribute in evidence terms?
We are very, very well. We are waiting, hopefully, by the week. For the evidence base to actually be published, we actually expect that sometime in the next few months. Certainly, the early sample data set that we've got has shown some incredible results based from the osteopathic fellowship team at Nottingham, run by James Booth. So we're expecting great things from it. We're really, to some extent, starting to talk about how good the results can be to the Chief Allied Health Professions Officer and others, and I think, you know, there's certainly beginning to hook interest, but we need those numbers. Yeah. But as I say, the early results that have come out, and I won't quote any quite now, but they are stunning.
Right.
In terms of effectiveness of osteopathy within a multidisciplinary environment, and actually the health economics argument of how much money we could be saving the NHS, if only.
Yeah, and that's interesting, though. It's in a multidisciplinary environment, which, of course, very few osteopaths practice in. Do you ever see osteopathy being offered on the NHS? Question from one of our audience.
Well, to some extent, via AQP, it is, as a sort of general thing. I mean, yes, that remains part of the goal of universal acceptance.
Yes.
It ain't going to happen in the next 10 years, I suspect.
AQP is a very specific example, isn't it? And it only applies to neck pain and back pain, certainly in my CCG area. Mm. And what's more, they've run out of money. And osteopathy costs them money, and they're not looking at how much it saves them. They're simply looking at how much it costs them.
But there are also other examples. I mean, Nottingham QMC is obviously one where osteopaths actually treat the surgical waiting list. Mm. You know, there are other examples of sort of local trust funded, CCG funded osteopathic unit doing great things. You know, with, again, with great all the data coming out. So you know, they do exist. They just are few and far between.
Yes,
we set up. Just a small consultation group called the NHS Working Group, where the people that we knew about who were actually leading these units came together just get into a room to start talking about what they did, how they got there, and actually what lessons could we learn. And one of the outcomes this year is we've now launched an internship program at QMC, but also at the Royal London Hospital for Integrated Medicine, which is part of UCH. Where osteopaths are given the opportunity to work as an intern within these two organisations to start the process of building that understanding, building that experience.
What's the uptake on that?
The interviews are about to happen. When we announced it in our e-bulletin connection, I think we got 37 applications in a space of 24 hours. I mean, there is interest.
Mm. James was telling me that the uptake for the fellowship had been actually very disappointing.
The fellowship program itself, yes, because there's a massive time commitment.
Yes. And there's a limited amount of money that the IO can put into it, isn't there?
And the internship itself, I think, is I suspect, will be the replacement program for that.
Yeah.
But the important thing is really to sustain and maintain programs like that, from which we can actually get NHS-based evidence around the effectiveness of osteopathy.
Yeah.
So, you know, we will continue to encourage and promote, I think, any opportunities we can which seek to, embed osteopathy within elements of other health providers, but also to start to encourage a better understanding of working with other professions in health. Because that really is one of our major challenges. I sit in meetings in Houses of Parliament or in other sort of cross-health groups where I just realise that the language we speak about health is completely different from that being used by our cousins who are GPs or nurses or surgeons. And we talk about different approaches, different things.
Yes.
If we are going to gain universal acceptance, we need to understand what their language means.
Yes.
And we need to express the benefit that we bring to them in those terms.
So what's the mood towards osteopathy in parliamentary committees?
I think they substantially ignore us at this stage. Mm-hmm. And we need to get organised. Part of what I think we need to do is... this year we actually have plans for higher investment out of the small pockets that we have to reinvest in policy. Mm-hmm. By actually... building better understanding of the needs of the rest of health so that we can actually realign how we express what osteopathy is in those terms. I think, secondly, to actually produce what I think is the core argument, the elevator pitch, if you like, that will grab the interest, which is, I think, the health economics argument.
Yes.
Yes. You know, while I completely agree that we could do with a lot more clinical evidence, actually expressing that clinical evidence and what it could save the NHS if only is the way that we need to pitch that data.
Yes.
You know, it's money that shouts, as well as patient care. So, and you know, from QMC, I think we will have the beginnings of a very solid health economics argument as to why the rest of health needs to.
Are you aware of any economic argument falling out from the AQP process? Because that's taken place in a number of CCGs. In my own CCG, their collection of data has been abysmal. They've insisted on PROMs for every single patient, right. And they have done nothing with the data, and they are unable to do anything with it for various reasons. But that ought to have been, the AQP program ought to have been a very useful way of measuring the financial benefits.
I had a conversation with people in NHS England about this earlier this year, and about the fact that it had kind of got lost between the transition from DH to NHS England. And they were saying, actually, they thought at some point they needed to revisit it. But I agree with you. I think it's disappointing when an initiative takes place that has the potential for osteopathy to get a foothold in certain areas. And, you know, we worked very closely with the BOA, as was, on ensuring that, not that we were trying to get involved with how AQP was run as the GOSC. What we did was to ensure that there were no regulatory barriers for osteopaths to take part. And that, to me, is a good example of the complementary role that we can play in terms of doing these things together. Well, of course, falling out over other things at other times. So there is a positive partnership. We talked about going to see the Chief Allied Health Professions Officer. It's convenient that sometimes we can open a door into the Department of Health or NHS England or any other health department and get the IO engaged with something that we wouldn't necessarily otherwise do.
Yes.
So you know, that seems to me a completely appropriate way of working together on things.
Yeah. Regarding the AQP program, I mean, did you have any influence? Do you have any influence on the development of that, or the continuing rollout, if you like, of AQP? And I ask because I remember that the procedure that one has to go through to get one of those contracts is bloody nightmare.
Yes.
There is no national AQP program anymore.
No, there's a standardised contract, isn't there, which they can adopt.
No, it's gone. In effect, it's gone. All of this is now the responsibility of individual clinical commissioning groups to do as they wish.
Yeah.
So while some are carrying on with AQP, in that there was a national program, there was a map, there was a rollout, there were PACs, there's all that stuff.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that's history.
So what should the individual osteopath or the osteopathic practice directors be doing now to get an NHS contract if it's now up to the local CCGs?
Right. I mean, I would love the IO to play a more coordinating and prominent role in supporting anyone who actually wants to do that, because we think it's a good thing to do.
Yes.
But, I mean, we need engagement from those who actually want to do it. They need to tell us what they want to achieve, and we need to get our act together to actually provide the right guidance and the right support. A lot of it is maybe about the health economics arguments. I mean, I talk to a number of CCGs where I meet them at conferences, and it's money. It's money and effectiveness, straight down the line.
Yeah.
So, and
again, it's not a level playing field, is it?
No, it isn't. We know we're coming from behind, and therefore we just have to make sure we have the right data and the right arguments to produce. And we can do, as the IO, as much as we can, and thank you for one of your commentators who suggested that we're doing quite a lot with small amount of money. We do, I believe. Mm. But therefore, you know, we do what we can really as an organizer and coordinator. You know, if we make a call for evidence and information or participation, we need osteopaths to come and play. Because if you come and play, you contribute, you know, your information, your enthusiasm to whatever project, then yes, we will start to make progress.
Yes.
Otherwise, we need the millions that we don't have.
We're coming to the end of our scheduled time, and I've got a couple of questions
quick
left.
Quick fire round.
The round of general ignorance. Yes. I'm, these go back to what we were discussing earlier on, and I just want to, I don't want to see anyone in our audience off, but first one is, what does the IO spend most of its money on?
Looking after members is the short answer. We an awful lot of our day-to-day income is around supporting the sort of member defence process. And otherwise, it's making sure that we continue to develop information content and support services for day-to-day practitioner osteopaths. Yeah. As I say, the £60,000 to £70,000 a year that we don't do that with is what we actually invest in the osteopathic development group programs, mm-hmm. Starting to invest in areas such as a policy officer, building resource tools for regional societies to use, and so on. So we have a fair number of small projects that are sort of seed projects. It's all about providing facilities for the profession to use at this stage.
We have a member of the audience who's got a bee in their bonnet about osteomyologists. Do you, Tim, have a sense that many people have moved to calling themselves osteomyologists to avoid regulation?
My sense is that the osteomyologist is not a strong organisation.
Well, the other part of the same question is that the chief exec of their association says that there's little that GEOSC can do about their members. I suspect there's no regulation to deal with them, their own members rather than osteopaths.
I'm never certain of the history of why the Association of Osteomyologists is established itself. I do know that the gentleman who founded it, who was also a GOSC registrant, died earlier this year. And I know he was the leading light in the association. Whether they will carry on, I don't know. I mean, for instance, I was looking at their website recently, which hasn't been updated for some months. So whether there's any activity there, I don't know. I don't get the impression that there are very many members of the association or that they're particularly prominent. I don't have a remit for them, so I'm not sure what their position is really.
But even so, a lot of the things that we have discussed would still apply, wouldn't they? If they claim to treat something as an osteomyologist, which the Advertising Standards Agency doesn't approve of, then the same sanctions would apply. They just wouldn't come through.
Well,
the
you know, actually, you know, if you look at the CAP website, you can Google osteomyologist, and it will give you something about them, which is kind of like, we're not really sure what this is at all.
Indeed. So, two things to finish on. First of all, Morris, the convention. Do you want to give us a quick burst on what we've got to look forward to?
Yes. We kicked off last year with a new format, which is multi-streaming our approach to networking and education. It was wonderfully popular in that, I think people actually found the mix of sessions on offer, I think, very lively and interesting. Yeah. But the key thing I actually want to say about it is that we set off last year not just about creating a more exciting convention, but actually with a deliberate aim to bring the profession together at it. Yeah. So it's not just about doing CPD, it's about coming to meet other people who may not share the same views that you have about how you approach your profession, and actually talking it out. Yes. And we had deliberately last year, and we'll continue this year, and actually having key proponents of cranial, visceral, MSK, whatever it is, on stage debating, because through that debate, typically in about 15 to 20 minutes, they start to agree. And ultimately, I think bringing the profession together is the cool thing about convention.
There are still tickets left?
There are tickets left, and they're running out, so please book.
So there we are. We have a deadline. You need to get your tickets now if you're going to go to the convention. It's on the 20th of November?
It's on the 20th of November, yes. 3 days of fun and frolic.
Is it self-funding or does it?
Is it self-funding? Yeah, we more or less. Just about break even on it. Yeah. So
more of you should buy tickets. Yeah. And then my final question is, and we touched on this before we actually came on air, who's the boss? Who leads osteopathy?
Osteopaths.
Yeah, there's no figurehead then. Yeah. Tim, you said earlier on you don't want to take on that role, and you don't want to be the leader of the profession.
I think there's. I think it would be a wrong. It would be wrong for the GOSC to seek to be the leaders of the profession. I think we're not a representative body. The IO is a representative body, and that has a different role. I think there's a more important underlying issue, and that's something that we've actually come together and thought about and acted on collectively as the Osteopathic Development Group, which is to establish a leadership program for the profession. And there are 20 people engaged at the moment. They've been working on this over the summer. It's a program we've developed with the Open University, developing leadership skills. We're hoping to run it for 3 years. And that is actually helping equip people with the skills that they need to be the leaders of the profession.
Right.
Leadership needs to come from the profession. It's not something we can do to the profession or for the profession.
Indeed. Thank you for that. Thank you both very much for an enjoyable, engaging, somewhat challenging talk. I hope we've answered the audience's questions. If there are more, as always, send them in and we will endeavour to get answers later and post them on the website. That is all the time we have for this evening. Once again, I hope you've enjoyed this broadcast. We're doing two of them a month. We're now moving to a fixed schedule of the first Wednesday in the month and the third Tuesday in the month, which hopefully will make it easier for you to programme. But until next time, thank you and good night.